This is Defy These Times, and I'm your host, Juri Ayoub. Hey everyone, Joey here. Today's kind of a special episode. It's going to be the first episode that I'm releasing on a Tuesday. I'm going to try and start releasing episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. There won't be two episodes each week because I can't yet handle that kind of workload. But that's sort of the goal. So for now, it will be on Tuesdays. As it happens, Tuesday will be one day after Nakba Day. Now, the Nakba, we will get into it in this episode. For those who don't know, it's the forced expulsions of Palestinians, including my grandfather, from the lands that ended up becoming part of the State of Israel in 1948. I wanted to have a conversation with my good friend Danelle Kurd, who has been on this podcast a couple of times before, so some of you may have already heard her speak. If you haven't, I do recommend it. It's both of them were largely on the topic of Palestine, but as we, you know, as often happens on this podcast, we ended up kind of finding links and kind of talking about everything, to be honest, or at least as many things as we found interesting to get into. In the coming weeks and months, you may see, as I just mentioned, like some irregularity in the output of this podcast. The reason for that is that I have finally finished this damn PhD, at the very least finished the writing of it. And now there's kind of a few weeks and potentially a couple of months of like admin-related crap to go into. And yeah, my mental space has been kind of saturated with that sort of thing, starting a new job here in Switzerland. Yeah, just a bunch of different stuff. So that's why you will see some irregularity. And I wanted to let you know so that you don't think that there's anything kind of wrong happening. Or, you know, don't worry. Everything's fine. Everything's going to be fine. And as I said, I do hope that in the coming months, potentially, this podcast will become a twice a week podcast rather than a once a week. We'll see. We'll see how things go. So, yeah. Why did I want to do something on Nakba Day? The Nakba is something very special for all the wrong reasons, unfortunately. For many people of a certain generation, it's a day that is sort of frozen in time. Many Palestinians of a certain age, many of whom, of course, are still with us, many have unfortunately passed away because we're talking about seven and a half decades now of settler colonialism in what is now Israel-Palestine. But the Nakba for me is a Nakba of silence. And I want to emphasize that because my grandfather never talked about it. He never mentioned much. The only thing I knew, or the only things I managed to collect information-wise has been either trying to get my grandma to say a few things or maybe other older relatives. And I was able to kind of patch a bit of a story here and there, just enough to know that he was indeed part of that expulsion, and that they had difficulties integrating into the almost as young state of Lebanon back then, to the point where part of his integration, quote unquote, or their integration, because this includes my grandmother, who is still with us, has been one of erasure. So you integrate by erasing where you come from, by basically not talking about it, by creating a different biography or autobiography for yourself and your family, and by sort of just telling that story. And so for a very long time, really the first two decades of my life, I had no idea that we were Palestinians. I just didn't know. Not just Palestinians for that matter, but we're also part Italian. So that's a different story for now, for another time. So I actually thought that we were from, I mean in this patriarchal sense of like where my paternal grandfather is from, are from this place somewhere in Zahle, which is in the east of Lebanon. And I remember very clearly going there one day with like on a school trip and going there thinking I'm going back to my roots. Little did I know back then that this was simply not so. And if I did want to go to my roots, I would probably just get shot by the IDF because the border, the southern border of Lebanon, which is obviously bordering modern Israel, is what, in the top five most dangerous borders in the world, let's say, give or take. So I wanted to have Dana on to talk about that, to talk about the Nakba. What does it, how do we relate to it? And Dana, by the time this is out, might have already published a piece. If it is, if that's the case, I will put it in the description. Reflecting on that as well. And crucially, we wanted to make sure that this is not an episode that is exclusively about the past. So kind of keeping in, you know, keeping to the same theme, if you want, as a good chunk of this podcast, the past is important. Nostalgia is important. Remembering is very important. But so is the future. And thinking about the future, thinking the future, is something which those of you who have been listening for some time now know that I hold dear. And I hope in this episode you'll get to see why that is the case. So anyway, as always, folks, thanks you for listening. I will quickly say, I know this has been a bit of a rather long introduction due to the admin stuff, but if you're not yet a subscriber of the Fire These Times or a supporter of the Fire These Times, you can head out to patreon.com/firethesetimes. You can find the link in the show note as well. And you can support with like $2 a month if you can't more than that. And of course, if you can, that would be much appreciated as well. I have potentially two optimistic plans. I don't know. Maybe they are unrealistic, but I have quite a lot of plans for this project. These first 3 years have been in many ways the beginning. Literally the beginning. But they've also been something that I've had to do here and there as much, you know, whenever I would find the time. It's kind of a miracle that it lasted this long, to be honest. While finishing a doctorate, I don't know how many freelance gigs and settling into a new place and dealing with the grief of what's been happening in Lebanon. Just so many, like, either disasters or difficulties, not to mention the pandemic and so on. And I want to do this project justice by kind of taking it to the next level. And I do need your support for that if you're willing to give it. Otherwise, that's also fine. You can support this podcast by sharing with your friends and families, leaving reviews on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, that sort of thing. If you want stickers, you can let me know. I usually send them to Patreons, but if you feel like distributing them in your local community or bookshop or whatnot, I love doing these things. And if you have any kind of ideas, projects that you want us to work on, even if you want to just like brainstorm with me, I'm pretty easily reachable, and you can find the email in the show notes as well, or you just go on the website, thefirethesetimes.com, and you'll find it somewhere there. And super last thing, I'm really sorry this lasted 8-ish minutes now. The newsletter still exists. I just haven't done much with it, but I will soon. So you can head out to Substack. I think it's thefirethesetimes.substack.com. And you can also subscribe on the website directly. You can choose either options. Thank you for listening, folks. I hope you find this episode meaningful. And yeah, again, just thanks a lot. Well, you've been here a few times already. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the Fire These Times. My name is Joey Ayoub. I'll be your host today, and as in, you know, most days. I'm joined here today by Dana Al-Kurd, who has been a guest, two or three times already so far. But Dana, for those who haven't listened to the previous episodes, which they absolutely should, of course, and they should feel bad if they haven't, can you introduce yourself?
Yeah, my name is Dana Al-Kurd. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Richmond. Work on authoritarianism in the Arab world, Palestine, and international intervention.
Mm-hmm. And so we're talking today, this was kind of a last minute thing, but it's the 75th commemoration of the Nakba. And so there's been a bunch of stuff being, you know, done, talked about, pieces, stuff on social media, whatever. And you've been writing this piece, which might be published by the time this comes out, about your own kind of, you know, thought process, let's say, when it comes to remembering the Nakba, thinking about the Nakba, commemorating the Nakba. The Nakba, I mean, I'm assuming most folks already know, but for those who don't know, it means catastrophe in Arabic. And it refers to the forced expulsion and ethnic cleansing of 700,000, I think it was.
Yeah. Conservative estimate, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Palestinians who mostly from the areas that are now part of the state of Israel. And these include, for that matter, my grandfather, who passed away a couple of years ago, and, you know, many other grandfathers and grandmothers and so on. Talk to us a bit about maybe your own thought process on this, you know, commemoration. What has it been like for you, and why did you kind of feel the need to write that piece, for example?
Yeah, I mean, I'm Palestinian. My grandmother also passed away a few years ago, but, you know, we grew up hearing about the stories and hearing about how it impacted the family and things like this. And when I was, you know, a young adult, politically aware, I mean, every year the I would participate in the commemoration of the Nakba, and whether that's like, you know, the protests or you know, vigils or something like this, like whatever's happening wherever I am. But we're coming up to kind of a milestone, 75 years, good round number. I worried that Nakba commemoration was becoming a bit of a stale dynamic, that people were starting to kind of engage in those activities around the Nakba, and I didn't feel like we were pushing forward towards anything. Like, it's kind of the wheel is turning. Every year seems the same. And then every milestone, it hits harder. Like, you know, hopefully we don't need to be in the same positions we are now. But imagine like the 80th anniversary, the 85th anniversary. It started to feel like, I don't know that we're learning much from each commemoration. I was actually asked to write that piece, and I didn't want to write another piece being like, you know, this Nakba was terrible and we deserve justice. I mean, everybody knows this. What can we use this moment to help us learn something? So that was kind of inarticulate, but my point was just to we should capitalize on you know, the point of remembrance and the point of commemoration to push our ideas forward, to strategize, to kind of reflect critically about what we've done right and what we've done wrong. Mm-hmm.
Thanks. It's really quite a lot. And so I was in Yerevan on the centennial of the commemoration of the genocide. So that was 2015, if I remember correctly. Yeah, 2015. And I went there with a couple of like Lebanese Armenian friends, and obviously I met Mokhfos there. I went there as a journalist, and I had some knowledge of the subject matter, let's say, because, you know, growing up in Lebanon, quite a few Armenians, you know, kind of know that story. Mm-hmm. And I did some research before going and so on. And when I went there, there was a lot of discussion, whether, you know, stuff that I've witnessed to the extent I was able to follow the conversation when it was kind of interpreted into English or Arabic, from Armenian, obviously, or online in books, writings. There was kind of this feeling, right, that a milestone has been reached. Again, this for whatever reasons, our brain functions with round numbers as well. There's something that happens, which is not interesting for now. Some other episode maybe. But yeah, it's a big, you know, 100, right? Like, it's mm-hmm. it felt at the time, and this was part of the conversation, that if nothing is done now, after that, you know, who cares about 101 and 102? Mm-hmm. And now it's what, 100, and it's gonna, yeah, 108, right? And there's something very fragile about how important specific numbers are, right? Mm-hmm. It kind of puts extra pressure in many ways, like for us to do something by a certain date or whatever. But there's something, of course, very different. I mean, many things. If for one, something that's called a genocide, Armenian genocide, has this kind of finality to it for, you know, obvious reasons. Mm-hmm. And most mm-hmm. folks were in the demands that were made were demands for recognition. Like, we need the Armenian genocide recognized. This was especially big in the US, for the US, with the Armenian community there, like Armenian Americans, because it was this huge thing. For those who don't know, Obama was supposed to do it and he didn't, and then Joe Biden ended up doing it. So it was like, a decade late. And there's, you know, politics was involved, as of course Turkey was, for obvious reasons, opposed to it and was kind of threatening using its, NATO status. All of these things kind of heated up in when the US did finally officially recognize, at the very least. At the end, it's kind of quote unquote symbolic. It's not just symbolic. There are concrete things that happen, but the symbolism of it is very important. And when it comes to the Nakba, we're dealing with a different situation, of course, and I'm not one to say, oh, better or worse, because, like, fuck that. It's just a different situation. And that situation necessitates a response that is concrete, right? Like, there is, when we speak about accountability, about justice, about the right of return, about whatever it may be, those are very concrete steps that supposedly should lead to concrete goals. And yet it kind of feels like, and I think it's not just a feeling, unfortunately. I wish it was. But that since, I mean, I wasn't old enough to remember, but from the literature I've read, but since roughly the Oslo Accord process, since basically the what was it, mid-90s, early 90s, there's been a sense of, like, something has been achieved and something else has to happen now. And then whatever that something else is has been kind of delayed, and now it's kind of a stalemate, if that's not probably the right term. I think you know what I mean. Especially in the form of, like, yeah, status quo, right? Like, especially in the form of, like, right now, what we consider, like, the representative, quote-unquote, of the Palestinian people being the PA, or technically the PLO, whatever. But, like, all of the problematic stuff that comes out of that, given their role right now, especially in the occupation in the West Bank. And it's sort of, I think it's true that this has also impacted how the Nakba is commemorated and thought about outside of modern Israel-Palestine, like in the diasporas. In Lebanon, there was every year, and still is every year, the Return Day, right? And all of these marches, the March of Return. And that were often, like, the only one I attended, a couple of them, and one that I attended, I think it was 2012. And for those who don't know, this is when a bunch of mostly Palestinians, but also some supporters, refugees or those who have the citizenship, in my case, Lebanese one, would go down to the south, so modern border of the north, of course, and basically try and return. Usually it's kind of like symbolic because, most people know that they won't manage.
Symbolic, yeah.
But there's a lot of, like, physical efforts, right? And some people get shot down, and there was a person who was shot in front of me, like when I was there, basically. And so it can get quite violent because of that, because the Israelis obviously just shoot to kill, and that's what they do on that specific day, especially. So, yeah, like, how... Just, yeah, try and respond to the jumble of words I just said. And, yeah, I have other thoughts, obviously.
No, I actually, it's... when I was writing this piece, and when I've been thinking about this last couple of years, it's not just been this nice round number, but I've really been reacting and trying to wrap my head around the stagnation that the Palestinian cause has found itself in. A large part of it has to do with what you described, which is the Oslo Accords, kind of derailing the national liberation movement, distracting a large chunk of Palestinian society with this process of quasi-governance and attempting to build a state in obviously without actual without a serious partner on those negotiations on the Israeli side. So I've been thinking about stagnation for quite a long time, and I often think about the Armenian experience because I used to live in Glendale. This is just like a little personal anecdote. So, I mean, there are, of course, Armenians in Palestine, but the first time that I lived with so many Armenians was in Glendale, and I still, am in touch with some folks from there. I was always impressed and in awe of Armenians for their ability to continue remembering and to continue commemorating And it clearly plays. And so I talk in the piece about how remembrance, and I'm not, this is not me coming up with it. I'm referring to Yassin al-Hashtala's discussions of remembrance. But like the function that remembrance plays, it plays a communicative function, it plays a social function, it creates a sense of community. And so I was always in awe of the Armenians around that it has been, like you said, it is a different process, but it has been a longer time frame than the Palestinians have been dealing with, and yet they still continue, and yet they're still committed. But at the same time, I used to feel the same kind of reservations I feel about ourselves, which is like, what is this achieving? Aside from that communicative function, aside from the social function, what is this commemoration actually going to achieve? And then, like you said, like under the Biden administration, we do get recognition for the Armenian genocide, but it's not the same as a demand for reparative justice. It's not the same kind of demand. So I often actually think about the Armenian and like what we can learn from Armenian or any other kind of commemoration, while still, of course, bearing in mind that in our case, in the Palestinian case, it's a settler colonial context. It didn't start with the Nakba. It didn't end with the Nakba, that moment in 1948. And so what does that also mean? And I think that you're right that the fact that there is kind of this political fragmentation and I don't know how to describe it, but like the fact that like large segments of Palestinian society in historic Palestine or outside are pursuing different objectives, essentially. So some people are talking about national liberation, and some people are talking about decolonization, and some people are not. And so because of that, I don't think that this moment, this impetus that the state should serve as, is used effectively. It honestly feels like a chore almost to some segments of the kind of Palestinian political spectrum. Like, okay, we're ch checking a box, like we're commemorating, we're going to put on our keffiyeh and sit and listen to a lecture and something like this, and it just doesn't seem that useful. So I was reading this political scientist who works on things like memory and remembrance and like the functions that they play in the context of Holocaust commemoration in Eastern Europe. Her name is Yelena Subotic, at Georgia's University of Georgia, I think. Whatever, you can look it up later. But she talks about how like there's a couple of reasons why remembering is important, and it should be tied to accomplishing justice. So first is the creation of a reliable record of past efforts, or sorry, past events. To offer a platform for victims to tell their stories and restore the dignity of victims, exposing the truth and public remembrance. And then the idea is essentially to repair the energy injury suffered by victims through restitution, reparations, or apologies. And so if we think about it that way, and again, still in the context of something that's ongoing rather than something that has happened in the past, I mean, I don't know that our Nakba commemoration accomplishes all of those tasks. So that's not on Palestinians alone. Obviously the international community bears a lot of blame for that. But in given that we know that context, we know that this is an international community that is Western focused and US driven, and that we're not going to get an apology, or that's not on the horizon in the immediate short term. What can we use Nakba Day for? That's essentially what my whole point was, and I have ideas. I think
I
maybe
mean,
some
sure,
Palestinians will
and
disagree,
it's
but
okay.
yeah.
Okay. So just I'll use the example I mentioned just because I wanted to make a different point, or like an additional point. With Turkey, the Armenian communities, well, the one that is in Turkey still is in Turkey in many ways as the one that struggles the most, and of course there have been even like threats and Hrant Dink. I'm mispronouncing the name, I'm sure, but an Armenian Turkish journalist was even assassinated some years ago. The Armenian community, which has been kind of active on the front of like recognize the Armenian genocide, for for the most part, doesn't expect the Turkish government to do so, because the Turkish government is the one that's obviously the main party against any kind of recognition to Armenian genocide, especially because it might imply legally, since they see themselves as the legal successors to the Ottoman Empire, it might imply, you know, actual legal and financial reparations of some kind. And that's, you know, part of, and then the others, you know, you have the usual nationalism, we did nothing wrong, we are amazing, that sort of stuff, which is kind of a definitely not something specific to the, or unique to the Turkish Republic, although it takes specific formats there. But I study a lot, memory, past, hauntings, all of that shit. I've been talking a lot about it on this podcast, but I haven't quite had the opportunity, if you want, except with, I think now, to talk about, like, what is it about that subject matter that felt so true to me, or at least felt so poignant, if that's the correct term. My master's thesis, and this sometimes surprises people, and my godfather says that I was trying to just be outrageous, but my master's thesis was on the politics of language, and the languages I chose were Yiddish and Hebrew. So, in the case of Hebrew, the language of the enemy, quote unquote.
I think it's actually a fascinating topic we should probably know more about.
It is really fascinating, so much about it that I will hopefully do more at some point now that I have a bit more mental space to do so. But it's a fascinating conversation because topic, and I'll briefly mention why. It's not the main topic here, but Yiddish supposedly, when it comes to Ashkenazim in Hebrew or in Yiddish, were the majority of Jews pre-Holocaust. Mostly in Europe and, of course, in Eastern Europe especially, a good percentage or a significant percentage were killed off during the Holocaust. And, of course, then Yiddish survived in the U.S. primarily. Now it's kind of associated with an older generation kind of thing. But also it survived in what ended up becoming Israel. And the thing about Yiddish is that because it, and this is a quote that was actually used, stank of the ghetto. This was an actual citation, used by a number of Zionist leaders in what became Israel. So in Mandate Palestine before that, they actually actively made an effort to suppress the speaking of Yiddish. Yeah. And they did that with all of the non-Hebrew languages that Jews were speaking, and to some extent still do, Arabic being a known example. But Yiddish, I always found it interesting because it's like, it's not as quote-unquote otherized in the mythos of Zionism, if you want, as, let's say, Arab is. If you want to do a binary between all Arabs and Jews, you cannot be both, then obviously you have to cast away the Arabic part. You have to say, like, this is the language of the other. But with Yiddish, it was quite difficult to do so because it was a very specifically Jewish language, and still is a very specifically Jewish language that was created in Jewish circumstances, context, and so on, and had a very specific role in political activism at the time, especially in, I'm gonna say, up until the First World War, it got a pretty huge hit, but of course with the Second World War was when there was, quote unquote, the final blow. And I bring that up, why? Because this already complicates the story, right? And for me, complicating the story doesn't mean cheapening it, or doesn't mean reducing the acknowledgement of other people's pains or the Nakba, for example. But I had a lot of pushback when I said that actually I wanted to understand what was it. I had read somewhere that, like, Yiddish was suppressed, and this really, it stuck with me. I'm autistic. I can't get rid of thoughts. It stuck with me. And I want to say, like, why would it be suppressed if, you know, it survived the Holocaust, it wasn't completely killed off and so on. Surely it should be the subject of a revival movement. As
no, but it's like it represents the failure
exactly
before the Israeli nation state.
Exactly.
And they want a new Sabra,
exactly,
you know, identity.
And Sabra, yeah, meaning the people who were born in the land, right? Like, named after
the strong colonizer.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot there, right? There's a lot in that picture that once we if we understand it, we are able to understand certain obsessions, really, that we see still present among especially Israeli Jews today, and especially in the form of the Israeli state. Like the sort of rhetoric that is used. Why is it used in this way and whatnot? There is a context to it. No one is born like that. And for me, understanding that and even learning a bit of Hebrew, which I've mostly forgotten now, I'll learn it eventually at some point again, allowed me to understand also my own experience better. Because my, as I said, my grandfather was exiled. And I kind of lived with that in the background for a number of years now. I found out pretty late. I didn't even know we were Palestinian up until like my teenage years. And for me, Nakba commemoration, for example, is silence. It's just the silence. It's the fact that we don't talk about it, or at least it was not talked about. And this is, you know, there's a very specific Lebanese component to that because of like we're Lebanese Christians, middle class, blah, blah, blah. And after the Civil War, it became taboo. Whatever. That's a topic for another conversation. But so I'm mentioning all of it because like when I say some, when I try and understand the complexity of a situation, it's not actually to reduce the pain and suffering that was ensued from the Nakba. On the contrary, there's something particularly, and this is something Mahmoud Darwish himself said, there's something particularly painful about realizing that a lot of the people who did your ethnic cleansing have some connection to one of the most traumatic, if not the most traumatic event in like the recent whatever century or whatever. And this there's something very difficult about that. Like there's something even more and more, I don't know. There's something very hard to, you know, because if it was like, oh, the Nazis, like we know it's a simpler story in some sense. Like the Nazis, there was white supremacy, obviously Aryan supremacy. They embedded the character of the Jew in their ideology and, you know, in Mein Kampf, it became like the main enemy and they had to purify the race, all of that shit. We know, so we're able to kind of trace a story, if you want. It's like, okay, clearly if it starts like this, maybe it's going to end like this. And we're able, at least I'm able to rationalize it. But when it comes to the Nakba, part of me still has a lot of difficulties understanding how, and this goes back to a very human thing, how a people, of course, it's not, and not everyone who was a Holocaust survivor ended up becoming Zionist, vice versa, but in the narrative of that Israel itself portrays, there was the Holocaust, 3 years later, War of Independence, the Arabs wanted to kill us, we won, and we got Israel. That's basically the narrative. And you have a lot of Israelis, including Netanyahu himself, who have said that, like, actually, Netanyahu himself actually said this, I have the quote, that, like, Hitler didn't even want to kill the Jews. He, after speaking to what was his name, that famous Mufti.
Amin al-Hussein, this is such a nonsense propaganda
exactly.
Point.
So he said in his own speech that like, oh, Hitler didn't want to do this, but after speaking to that dude,
it was
Sam,
the Arabs at fault the
exactly.
entire time.
So
yeah.
And
no, it can't be just white supremacy.
Exactly, but this shows that even in the case of the survivor, quote unquote, I hope people know that I come from a good place here, but this type of language is very tricky. But in case of like Netanyahu in the mythos that he, for example, himself put forward, right? It was no longer too convenient, or at least it was more convenient to focus on the Arabs than it was to focus on the Germans. It's more convenient to do so today because Germany is no longer Nazi Germany. It's kind of our ally, blah, 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 blah.
And I mean, the Israeli discourse, it relies on having to replace the Nazis with the Palestinians.
Exactly.
And they I mean, I'm not the first person to say this, obviously, like there's much been written about this, but like the Palestinian is the Nazi for them.
Yes.
A Palestinian is not a national identity. It's somebody who prescribes to wanting to kill Jews. Mm-hmm. Like that is to them how they view a Palestinian, which is why, you know, they get so angry when somebody identifies as a Palestinian. The first thing they say is, you're an anti-Semite.
Mm-hmm.
To be a Palestinian is to be an anti-Semite. To be a Palestinian is to be the reincarnation of Nazism. They need it. They need it in their ethos because otherwise, like you said, like how do you in 2023 rationalize a government and a regime that engages in this way but has the Holocaust in its past?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how can you engage in both things? Oh, these people must be just the reincarnation of our old enemy.
Yeah,
essentially.
Yeah. Exactly. And this, like many many scholars in that I've myself used, have even argued that this is, in Netanyahu's comment, for example, was slammed by a number of Holocaust historians as a form of Holocaust denialism. Denial, because
wow.
there is there's different forms of that, right? And one of them is to just state out, deny it, which, you know, Nazis usually do and whatever. But there is a different way of denying it, which is like to downplay the role of
the Jewishness.
Nazis. Exactly, exactly.
And the Jewishness of the issue.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, okay. I'm mentioning this because in my own work, we're focusing on post-war Lebanon, so not even on that specifically, although there are parallels due to geography, whatever. There are like at least echoes here and there and some links here and there and whatnot. For one, like a bunch of Lebanese elites at the time were part of the colonization efforts, and this is not something that they want to think about too much. The Sousse family is a known example for those who study that part of Lebanese history, that sold land that they had in Israel, in what became Israel, to the, what was it called, the Jewish National Fund, right? And so anyway, so there's a lot of these nuances that we can get into, but I'm mentioning this because there are a number of concepts, like the concept of remembering, the idea of remembering. I forgot which scholar did that, but like you can kind of cut it into remembering, in the sense that you can think about it as something that we're thinking about the past, but we're focusing on the present. What is it about the past that can inform the present? What is it about the present that can render justice to the past? So it's a relational identity. It's not just something that's static, that's in the past, and that we just need to essentially kind of like a religious ritual, kind of just repeat it on a yearly basis.
Just some stale kind of,
yes,
charade.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even when it comes to nostalgia, and here then I'll let you talk because I've been talking for a long. But in terms of nostalgia,
no,
Svetlana Boim, who's kind of one of the scholars, on the main scholars on this topic, had written a book called The Future of Nostalgia, in which she the focus, and I have it here because I didn't want it to get it wrong, she focused on two types of nostalgia. For one, for those who don't know, the term nostalgia was first used to describe Swiss mercenaries, because Switzerland had mercenaries that would be sent off to the rest of Europe to fight, and so they would feel this homesickness towards Switzerland, and so that's how it stuck. And it was seen as an actual psychological disorder, something to be treated. But nostalgia has two components, and this is one of her brilliance, I think. But so you have restorative nostalgia, in which case you would put emphasis on nostos, this is a Greek word, returning home. And here I'm paraphrasing, proposes to rebuild the lost home and patch up the memory gaps, end quote. Right? Like, this is the type of nostalgia that said, like, something wrong happened in history. We need to effectively turn back the clock in one way or another, and then everything will be fine. Oh, well, I'm simplifying. But that's that impulse of, like, we need to go back, stop what happened, or prevent what happened. That's the whole, like, kill baby Hitler kind of thing. And, you know, the rest wouldn't have happened. So that's the restorative. So it's about a nostalgia, which is pretty common, that seeks to restore a past glory. And we often see this in the golden, you know, Arabs do this quite often, right? Like the golden age of like the 50s and the 60s, especially when Nasser, blah, 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 and Kulthum, you know, that sort of thing.
Or no, the monarchists.
The monarchists.
Jesus, yeah.
It's a very specific breed of that.
Yeah.
But so that's restorative nostalgia. But then there's reflective nostalgia. And I think this is, if you want to put it like more conservative versus more progressive tendencies, although I'm sure it's more complicated. But reflective nostalgia focuses on the second part of that term, which is algia, which means aching. So longing and loss, the imperfect process of remembrance. I.e. it sort of inherently acknowledges that the process of remembering itself, the process of nostalgia, which is a type of remembering itself, is by its definition incomplete. It can never be completed. And we shouldn't kind of act, if you want, as if it can ever be completed, as if we can ever do something that says, okay, we have stopped this thing, now we no longer need to remember to do whatever, and so on. And this, of course, is, you know, generationally it changes. Remembering the Holocaust today is not the same as remembering the Holocaust in the 50s, and so on and so forth. But the reason why I bring that up is that I do think when it comes to Nakba commemoration, at least the ones that I have specifically, and I want to be very clear here, I don't know all of them, and I'm not speaking about, and I don't know, like I haven't been to most of them. I've just been to the ones in Beirut, and a couple of them in London. So that's been my experience. The Beirut one I feel is a bit more informative, but the London one is probably speaks a bit more to the experience of the ones in the US, because it's like a more distance diaspora thing, whereas with the one in Lebanon, there is that physicality of it, of going up to the border and so on. And I have found myself, it's almost, again, I mentioned this religious aspect of it. it's almost like, you know, I would go to church at the time when I would still go to church, and I had certain hymns to memorize. I had a sort of, I knew when to stand, when to sit. There was a sort of a ritual aspect to it. And I'm not saying ritual is bad. I actually think ritual, there's a value in ritual. But there's something that is done, and this, you know, even the religious would say so, when the ritual becomes an end in itself. When the ritual becomes like just something to do, you know, the people, for example, who just fast on Ramadan because you're just supposed to do it, versus a friend of mine who's actually not religious, but, you know, of Muslim background, who does fast in Ramadan because he sees this as has some kind of cultural significance. He has imbued it with, he has actually added value to it that wasn't necessarily there, or that you know, he could have just not done it, right? And so the same for other religions and whatnot. Anyway, I have talked for so long. I'm sorry. Clearly we've opened a whatever it's called, floodgate here.
No, this is fascinating. This is fascinating. I agree with you. I mean, the way that the Nakba day has been played out in my life in different contexts, whether it's in the United States, there have been a couple of Nakba days I lived through in Doha. Like, it's honestly been a very, I mean, obviously it's going to be a sad day, but it's felt defeating because I feel like we, I mean, aside from the kind of side effect of building that community, and especially now in the United States, there's a lot of kind of focus on regenerating the commitment of like young people to the national identity. Like, absolutely, that it's the Nakba commemorations are all accomplishing that. But yeah, I think it's we're not engaging in that second type of nostalgia. We're engaging in a lot of the first, and to make it feel useful. We could do this on any day, but, like, you know, human beings, like you said, we like round numbers and we like commemoration dates and things like this. To make it useful, I think that, you know, Nakba Day should be kind of a taking stock. Like, we should take stock of, okay, especially in the last couple of years, like, we've had the Unity Intifada. What have we learned? Where have we failed? What can we do more? Where are we now? Because we really, I mean, this is not a personal failing necessarily. I'm not saying like the Palestinians are like just uniquely failing at something like this, but there are like obviously structural reasons why, in the diaspora context, in the context of increased repression of pro-Palestine sentiment all over the world, that you can fall into a rut. You can take the safe thing and do a small protest, do a lecture, and move on with your life. The really kind of, maybe not the word unsafe, but the more challenging thing to do would be to critique, would be to self-critique, and to say, okay, let's try to move forward from this. And yeah, I mean, we've talked in the past, we've talked on this podcast about how we Palestinians have been shying away from that kind of critique. Yeah, there are many reasons for that. But essentially in the piece, I'm just like, here are the things that I think we need to think about. Here are the two things that I think are, you know, the main impediments to us using this day effectively. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, so we talked about, yeah, we talked about the impediments, we talked about even the structural reasons and so on. There's always a difficult thing. We do have, I mean, humans in general, I think, have a tendency, because it's easier to focus on what's wrong than focusing on what is not right, but like what can be done. What are the things that can actually be improved, and can actually like yield concrete results? And so obviously, solving the crisis, quote unquote, is difficult. It will be difficult regardless, but difficult doesn't mean impossible, and it doesn't mean that nothing can be done. No, it's not like everything has to be done, otherwise nothing can be done. Like, there is this kind of all or nothing situation, which again is difficult. I'm not this, in no way is it a recognition that people are failing or whatever. It is just what it is. And you know,
but even recognizing the geopolitical context, like you said, there is space to move.
Yes, exactly. You know? There's space to move in the geopolitical context. There's space to move within like the US context specifically. There's different space, like in a different way in the UK than there is in mainland Europe, for that matter. And in the Arab world, there's a completely different thing happening. Like it's almost like it's arguable. I mean, I think it's even easier to talk about Palestine right now in the US than it is to talk about Palestine in much of the Arab world, if it means anything actually concrete, like do something or something has to be done. Thinking about like Egypt, for example, or whatever. So in your view, what for example, you mentioned Yassin Hajj-Saleh, you mentioned, so the Syrian experience, what was it about, maybe you can focus on that if you want, what was it about that experience, what is it about that experience that you felt like can actually inform also your own assessment, if you want, of where we are now as Palestinians, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, Yassin is, I think, brilliant. And I think the way that he thinks about remembrance and almost like the inability to remember, I can't remember exactly the terms he uses, but like how when something is just so traumatic, and especially in the Syrian case, like ongoing, essentially, that there becomes a failure to represent and to express, which is what the Syrian people have been dealing with under this, you know, most vicious of regimes. And so he's kind of thinking about it in a different direction, which is like, what happens when we can't even remember? What does that mean for, you know, the people who can't express, who can't represent, who can't remember? They turn to violence, they turn, you know, those kinds of things. And so I don't think that the Palestinians are actually in that space. I think that the Syrians are dealing with something much, much worse, because whereas I'm not saying the international community is friendly to the Palestinians by any means, but I think that, I mean, we have won a lot of narrative victories. Yeah. And I think it's we've discussed this, like, I think it's easier for people to recognize and understand the Palestinian issue in a way that I don't think the Syrians, unfortunately, get that same kind of recognition. And like you said, there are Palestinian communities in the diaspora in places where, of course, it's imperfect. Of course, we face criminalization of all of those things. But at the same time, we are allowed to express. Like, there's no question. It's not, we're not in, you know, Assad Syria, unable to express. We are able to express and face consequences. You know, for example, the Palestinians in the German yes, context, yeah, they do face consequences expression, but we are able to. So actually, like, when I was reading this, you know, I was like, this is actually much more extreme. Like, we're not dealing with that level. We are dealing with something, thankfully, we have more space actually to maneuver than the Syrians. The Syrians are still at much earlier in this process. But yeah, I mean, the reason also I read Yassin or people like him or people who come from that kind of positionality is because I think that's one of the things that I critique. Like, let me back up. Sorry, just to be more articulate. I think with Nakba Day, we need to take stock and recognize where we've been succeeding. We've succeeded on the narrative front. We've succeeded even in academia. I think and I'm not the first person who said this, but like Khalidi said, like, you know, it's in amongst historians, for example, nobody seriously engages in Nakba denialism. It's you know, it's for the extremist margins, right?
The debate is more like, what type of colonialism is this? Like, there isn't a debate
exactly.
Of like, is this no, I mean, it's not that serious of a conversation to deny it completely. It's like what kind? Is it settler? Is it this? Is it that? You know, those are the actual...
How bad is it? But exactly. So, like, nobody's saying anymore, which they used to, that this didn't happen, that Palestinians don't exist. Those are the most completely unserious people only engage in that kind of conversation. So we've won those battles. We've won the battle of regenerating a commitment by, you know, amongst young people. We've won those. But then also let's think about where we need to improve. And when we think about the Syria case, like, this is my biggest thing, like, where we need to improve, where we are still kind of parochial. Like, we are still not connecting the Palestinian issue with other issues. It's not just an anti-colonial struggle. Palestine is a part and parcel, not even the I'm not going to even claim like the centrality or the face of, but it's part and parcel of a global anti-authoritarian struggle. And when we don't frame it that way, I think that we find ourselves on the wrong side of things sometimes. And so with the Syria example, like we should have done a better job of engaging with what's happening in Syria and how that connects to us, or what's happening in Iraq or what's happening in Iran. And that failure on our parts is, I think, why we haven't been able to build as effective of transnational solidarity. And I've said this before, like a lot of our attention when it comes to, to the international sphere or the any kind of transnational activity has been towards the West. And we really fail when it comes to people just closer to home. Like we don't know how to engage in transnational solidarity with our own region. So that's one thing. And then, yeah, I mean, I have other things that we can talk about, but with the Syria context, like that's where I brought that in because it weighs heavily on how I see Palestine organizing spaces engaging and developing.
Yeah, that's why I'm pretty interested by the Kurdish example, the Kurdish experience, because it's so it's quite literally divided by four na modern nation states, and there is an identity that crosses these nation states clearly, but some of the actual or more, if you want, more consequential differences between Kurds. And here I'm thinking specific, especially Syria, Turkey, again, modern nations is Syria, Turkey, Iraq. The Iranian one I'm slightly less familiar with the exception of what's been happening more recently with the death of Jina Amini and just the suppression. I know that Kurds in Iran, like Iranian Kurds, are suppressed and are oppressed, and even the language is suppressed and so on. But for example, when the experience of northern Syria, there's actually some, for example, more similarities between a supporter of the YPG or the SDF and a supporter of the PKK, so a supporter of Tur in Turkey and a supporter in Syria, let's say, than there is between I forgot their initials in English, but with the Iraqi government, Iraqi Kurdistan administration government, so in Iraq. And so it's not the
The
Kurdishness, KRG,
KRG.
yeah. So it's not the Kurdishness of it that here separates them, because there is that in common. But what separates them is effectively political, regardless of which side people want to be on, whatever. I'm saying that objectively, like analytically, you can kind of say that, okay, well, clearly there is a border, and the border obviously has an impact. But there is also kind of a cross-border exchange, and sometimes physical exchange, like people are actually crossing, if whether they're refugees from Syria to Turkey, or whether they are Kurds who are citizens of Turkey going to Syria to fight either ISIS at the time or whatnot. And so that has created a kind of a different or a very interesting dynamic, which, especially when it comes to the Armenian example I mentioned before, there is an interesting intersection between the Armenian experience and the Kurdish experience. For one, a common oppressor, for the most part, historically, being the modern Turkish government, the Turkish Republic, I should say. But also, historically, there wasn't necessarily very good ties between Armenians and Kurds, because Kurds were seen, and to a large extent this was true, as actually the foot soldiers of the genocide, because they were conscripted by the Ottoman Empire at the time. And so there's a lot of bad blood, quote unquote, in the sense that today, one of the examples I use in my own thesis is that in the early days of the after the Arab the uprising, the revolution in 2011, I think this was 12, 13, a number of Syrian Kurds, refugees in Lebanon, were discriminated against by Lebanese Armenians, citing that 100 years ago crime that was committed by the ancestors of these Kurds, whatever, right? Like, this is in the sense that when we say, okay, this is, we're just, of course, we're not actually, or we shouldn't actually blame descendants for what like happened 100 years ago, but other people are doing that in one way or another. And so there is a political component to this, is what I'm trying to say. And for me, this is something that I'm trying to wrap my head around in a way that's, trust me, very complicated, and I haven't quite managed to find all of the words I want to write something longer on this topic. But when I think about whether it's the Holocaust, whether it's the history of Zionism, whether it's the post-48 dynamics, whether in the Arab world or in terms of like Israel's relations to the rest of the world and so on, there's just so many threads kind of being created there, that putting them together or linking them in one way or another feels to me less about, if you're following the metaphor here, which is probably a bad one, but it feels less about creating a straight line, because that's probably not possible, but more about creating some kind of web, in the sense that there is some kind of, you know, you could be on this position is, or at least this is your experience, and maybe your experience as like an American Jew who has Holocaust survivors and Holocaust victims in your background, right? Like your grandmother or your great-grandmother, whatever. Maybe that has created historically some connection between you and African Americans. And we know this has happened. There is that link, American Jews were disproportionately involved in the civil rights movement to give Black Americans more rights and so on, right? Like this is actually documented. And there are these historical reasons. But like if you're a Palestinian and you read about this and say, well, there are these historical reasons. Okay, and what are these historical reasons? Well, both of our ancestors suffered. Right, like both of our ancestors as Jews and as Black Americans suffered in these gruesome ways. Of course, they would be thinking about the Holocaust, about maybe the repression under the Soviet Union, and of course, in the case of African American slavery and then Jim Crow and all of that stuff. So then that has been created. That link has been created there. What can then be created from that experience with other experiences? And so one chapter that I wrote some years ago was looking at this, the Black Palestinian, so African American and Palestinian American specifically, links, which, you know, many people have written about this. Marian Baruti has written about this. I have, other folks have. You know, we saw this with Ferguson in 2014, right? We saw all of these things happening. But for me, it's like, okay, well, you have this and this, these two communities on this side, and these two communities on this side. The only thing they seem to have in common is that they've built bonds with African Americans. But where is the bonds between Jewish Americans and Palestinian Americans? And now we've been seeing that, right? That we've seen Jewish Lives for Peace. Is that the word? Yeah.
Jewish Voice for Peace? Voices, yeah.
972 Mag does a bit of that. Jewish Currents does that, the magazines. So there is that recognition that there is trauma in our past. But that does not mean that talking about these big we categories, that we haven't also inflicted trauma on other people. Like those two don't have to be contradictory. In fact, they're often not necessarily. They don't have to cancel each other out, right? Which is a bit how the Israeli state acts. And my argument is that I think to some extent, and I don't know to what extent, but to some extent, the Arab states have kind of just played the other side of that coin, post-48. In the sense that there was this binary created, the Jew on one side, the Arab on one side. And that sort of is something that the Arab regimes, like I'm thinking of the monarchy in Iraq at the time, I'm thinking of even Gamal Abdel Nasser to some extent, have sort of played along with. Like every Arab Jew was potentially a spy for Israel. Many of them were accused. Many of them were then expelled. And of course, the population has basically shrinked compared to it was pre-70s, for example. Lebanese Jews pre-70s, there was a sizable population. And post-70s, post-80s especially, very few remaining. I think it was a couple hundred officially or whatever now. So, you know, all of this to say that a historical wrong that was done does not mean that everyone involved on the other side of that historical wrong, and here I'm specifically talking about Arabs broadly, not necessarily Palestinians, because Arabs broadly have also taken on the mantle of saying, like, you know, the cause awlawiyatna, right? Like it's our priority. Yeah. And so this means something, right? Like this means that we've also taken on these sort of we have a baggage that I think is difficult to I'm butchering all of the metaphors here. Like it's difficult to completely unload it, right? And I think there has to be an aspect of the solution or aspect of the way forward to recognize this baggage. Doesn't mean that your baggage is unjustified. On the contrary, it's very justified. But there is a baggage. It exists. It's there, and it colors the way you act. It colors your perceptions of the future, and that's why. And I'll stop on this because Jesus Christ, I'm rambling. Sorry. But like I'll stop on. The book Palestine Plus 100 came out a few years ago, and I did a review on it also some years ago. But that's one of the early indications that I saw of this kind of futurism thinking. And obviously, people who know the podcast, is something I'm trying to engage in a lot. Like thinking of like, what does 2048 looks like? That, you know, now we're at 75, what does 100 looks like? And a lot of the stories, these are science fiction stories, obviously, they're short stories. A lot of the stories, I would argue, haven't gone out of that mental prison, right? If I want to put it that way, like there, it's still like basically is what's happening now just worse, essentially. Like Israel has just found more creative ways of being Israel. While others, a couple of them, and now I'm spacing out on the names, have kind of thought of very actually creative alternatives, like this might have happened or this might have happened and so on. And I think this kind of training, this kind of exercise, if I should say, is extremely necessary. Like the past has to be a starting ground towards something else. And like, you know, Indigenous Americans say this, or Indigenous people around the world say this, and African Americans have also been saying this, I think, like we need to be better ancestors. Like we need to acknowledge our ancestors and what they went through, of course. And I think we do this. I think we often do this. But we need to also recognize that we are ancestors, as in we will be ancestors, right? Like that's just how it works. And we need to recognize that and kind of wrestle with that, because it's not easy. Go for it.
Yeah, it's really difficult. The way that you're describing, like, recognizing your position in the web.
Yeah.
It's incredably difficult. In this context, because it is ongoing.
Yeah, exactly.
I think Mahmoud Mamdani kind of makes a similar claim that to find a common future, you have to get rid of the binary between victim and perpetrator. And that sounds great, but
it's very
in the context of ongoing, yeah, like in the context of ongoing aggression, it's not just difficult. I think it might be premature almost to discuss, because right now there are perpetrators, right? And even historically, like if we're talking just about the Palestinians and Israelis, like historically speaking, I'm sure, you know, like this attack or that attack, or victims lost on this side or civilians lost on that side, whatever. So I'm not claiming like only one side was violent or anything like that. But at the end of the day, like the settler colonial project started from one side, right? And it's difficult to have that discussion about where you are in that web before the violence ceases. That's a separate matter, I think, from engaging in these adjacent communities, in these connected communities, like American Jewish communities, I think that's a different thing. Like, I mean, I'm sure, you know, a lot of the American Jewish establishment is implicated, but it's not in the same way as somebody who lives in Israel or like who serves in the IDF or things like this. And so that's, I think, where that kind of work can be more meaningful. On the ground, it's more difficult. But in terms of like Arab regimes, and I mean, these are like the most, like, you know, morally bankrupt, autocratic, you know, systems. It's not so surprising that they are, I don't know how to say this. It's not so surprising that they're engaging in a binary. It's not so surprising that they're weaponizing Palestine. Like that.
That's what they do.
You know, that's what they do. And now, actually, in the context of the Abraham Accords, it's very interesting, because now there's like an opposite weapon, like the 180 weaponization. Now there's a weaponization of tolerance and a weaponization of peace. The word peace, the word tolerance, to justify increased suppression of Palestinians and increased authoritarianism and authoritarian linkages. So, I mean, I'm just like, I don't take anything that the Arab governments say at face value. Like they're not a serious part of the discussion. But yeah, I don't know, that those are just my thoughts. Like very rambling.
No. That's completely fair. And the reason why I brought that up is that it's so when I speak about futurism, for example, and thinking of like, yeah, okay, what. Let's say ideally we want to get rid of the perpetrator victim binary. Let's say we want that, and we know that it's not going to happen now. We know why, because the aggression is ongoing, the occupation is ongoing, the colonization is ongoing, the blockade is ongoing, and so on and so forth. But what can it look like if we give ourselves permission to imagine a future in which that's possible? And yes, there is privilege in that. Like there is a sort of a, oh, well, you have time to sit back and think about
it. And we're more separate.
You know, you have that. And yeah, absolutely. I, like, in no way would I deny that. But I think this isn't historically unusual. Like, a number of the people who had the time, if you want to even organize, to be part in organization, to do certain things, not always, of course, and in no way would I want to erase like working class efforts and so on, but a number of them were middle class. And there is a reason for that, is that they found themselves, if we want to think of this web, in a specific positionality in which they...
That has more privilege.
They have more privilege, and so more time and more resources and more whatnot. And I think this has to come with more responsibilities as well. And you have those who recognize it and those who abuse it and those who not, blah, blah, blah.
You know, it's so interesting that you say that, because my one of the points I make in the piece is that, like, or actually, I can't remember if it's this piece or another piece I wrote, but like, we often... We Palestinians, I'm speaking kind of generally here, but like, I feel like we, you know, we engage in litmus tests, we engage in this kind of like puritanical, like, who is really Palestinian, who is like really a good representative, who is really has skin in the game, instead of recognizing that like we, Palestinians are this like large diaspora, large population with a variety of lived experiences, and we all have different positionalities and different points of privilege, and that's something that can be leveraged, and instead of seen as like, you know, basically like the kind of like the folks, the maybe the intellectuals, the middle class, whatever, that are going to be engaging in that kind of like thinking of the future, and trying to imagine, you know, alternatives, they're seen as somehow problematic, or something that shouldn't be engaged with, or something that should be made distant from the cause, when actually like we should totally capitalize on those kinds of privileges. But yeah, I mean, back to Palestine 100, sorry, this just one last comment. I don't know how to, like, you know, this is not my area of expertise, like, I do research in political science, but I remember reading that and feeling very unsatisfied, and feeling very like, it's very like just suffocating, actually, to think about the fact that this was what was imagined for 100 years after the 90s, and it's not a, like, nothing. I don't remember a single story being a positive imagination.
No, that wasn't.
There is not a single one. Yeah.
But you know, so to just go back to quickly the example you just gave as well, because for those who may challenge the premise of my argument that, like, we need to think about the future, we need to engage in futurism, even if you're not like a science fiction person, whatever, the best example I can give are the existing ones that already exist, like the indigenous futurism, Afrofuturism, there's like disability futurism, queer futurism, all of that stuff. These are coming from points of departures that are like so laden with trauma and horrors, and like, very few things can be compared to the African American experience, just in terms of like the horrors of the past, and indigenous experience as well, not just in the US for that matter, especially in Latin America and so on, and other places. But that doesn't, there's kind of this, and this is a post-60s thing especially. Baldwin talks about this at some point, and Martin Luther King himself talked, lots of folks have talked about this, from Nina Simone to Angelo to, like, I don't know, so many people have talked about this. That there has to be a work to create. Because, okay, let me backtrack a bit. This comes from the recognition, and this James Baldwin talks about that. And for those who don't know, this podcast is named after one of his books. That white people are also trapped. Like, that white supremacy clearly creates a perpetrator and a victim. Like, that's very obvious. The KKK, Jim Crow, policing Nazis. Today, Nazis. It's a very obvious situation. If you at least it's a very clear one for those who want to think about it. But recognizing also that white supremacy makes white people sort of fragile. That's why white fragility comes from. As in, like, the very idea of a autonomous black person, or independent black person, or just a black person, can be a threatening thing to that fragility. And so Baldwin recognized this, and he said, well, if that's the case, that means that we in some ways have more power than we thought we have, in the sense that there is something in us that seems to scare them. And what is it that, what is that thing that scares them, and why does it scare them? And it's not about me. I didn't do anything. I was just born. It's not like I caused anything. And it's a whole, like, you know, I'm not the N-word. I've never been the N-word. It's not something that has ever been part of my identity. But this is something that they have created, like the white people have created, right? And no, I'm just mentioning this because it's a known example, especially in the West, maybe in Anglophone circles and so on. And I think it's a very interesting case study because it's ongoing in many ways, as we know, with policing, with the prison system in the US and so on. There's a lot of talks of reparations. There's a lot of things that are there that are definitely worth studying and learning from, because they are managing to do things that we haven't necessarily managed yet. Doesn't mean that we are failing. We're just at a different point in history in that web, right? Like there's just certain things that we've managed to do and whatever. It's not, you know, there's this contest mentality that I don't like. I'm just saying that this is just what happened. These are part of their struggles, and part of their ways forward in their own story, in their own narrative, is to think in the future. That's the whole I have a dream thing, right? To think of a future where my kids or my grandkids or someone else's grandkids, whatever, doesn't have to go through the things that I have to go through. That's simple. It's really that basic. It's a very simple thing. And that's what I mean by being better ancestors. And I think that specifically in our context, there is a bit of that lacking. It does exist here and there. I have seen it. I've talked about it with some folks. I've experienced it in many ways. But it lacks this wider framework in which we understand that effectively what we need is to build some kind of power. And you can do so in the right way, in a healthy way, grassroots way, bottom-up way, you can say, or you can do it like, you know,
in a moral way.
Yeah. Or you can do it like, you know, I'm just going to stick with my friends regardless of how butchery they are.
The enemy of the exactly. enemy is my friend. Exactly. Yeah.
And I think this is where I still wrestle with that. But yeah.
No, I'm with you. I think it takes such a strong and radical outlook to be able to engage in that kind of futurism. I am a depressive person, like personally.
Fair enough.
And it's difficult sometimes for me to be or to engage in any kind of optimism. That's just a me problem. But I mean, also like It is a little scary because I really want people to engage in that line of thinking. I think it's really important, and I think you're right that it's necessary. But at the same time, like the world, I mean, the Arab world has been falling apart, and then the rules of the game in the world is also becoming increasingly vicious. Like we had like a very brief respite in human history, in modern human history, and now it's becoming like increasingly vicious, like with like Russia's invasion of Ukraine, with ongoing occupations and like escalating repressions in places like Kashmir and like Western Sahara. I'm like concerned that it just can go very very bad. Mm-hmm. Like we might not even have a space or an opportunity to engage in that futurism. Like we might see another ethnic cleansing. We, you know, like that, unfortunately, that like that's the context that that we are operating under. And yeah, sorry to leave it on such a negative note, but
I mean, especially now, I mean, it's
terrifying.
It's open. It's these are open things being said right now by the Israeli government that, you know, while a minister here and there has said so in the past, right now, it almost feels like they are kind of building up to something more coherent.
No,
and more,
they're doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Or even like when the Russian forces steal Ukrainian children. Mm-hmm. And say that they shouldn't exist. I mean, like, these are the standard like operating procedures now in the world. I mean, when it used to be something that like was condemned, mm-hmm. and it's incredibly concerning. And so that's again goes back to like Palestine needs to be connected with a broader anti-authoritarian struggle, because if these are the standard operating procedures, like we are so screwed.
Yeah. Yeah,
like
yeah.
We do not have the power imbalance between us and the people who would see us erased. Like. Is really wide.
Yeah, I mean, just to go back to that web, I think we need to find a way to position ourselves in a more ethical way, and also in a more long-lasting way, right? Like there are ways to think about, well, okay, who are our friends, quote unquote, and are they good friends? are they friends that maybe we need to re-question our friendship? You know, that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, okay.
There's so much.
But Dana, thanks for this. I mean, this was Yeah, very rich. Usually I ask folks to recommend three books in the end, as you know, but I also forgot to do this time because we decided at the last second. If you, I can mention, what am I doing? I just lowered my hand and I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Sorry. This listeners don't know what I'm doing, and that's fine. But I will recommend, I've been reading Timothy Snyder recently. My mind is a lot on Ukraine these days because of what's happening, but also because of where I live. And there's a lot happening there that is so consequential that it's actually a bit dizzying to think about all of the, like, it's arguably as consequential, if not more so, than like the collapse of the Soviet Union, for example. And that's something that we take for granted, that it just collapsed. But that it wasn't taken for granted up until like the second it did. And so a lot of things are happening, and this can have some kind of domino effect, who the fuck knows. And the trends between the trends in the Arab world towards both normalization of Israel and also normalization of the Assad regime, which
it's just normalization of terribleness,
normalization of everything that's shit, just normalization of this is a shitty state of affairs and we're fine with it basically, and we're gonna actually profit out of it. I find it fascinating in a purely intellectual way and depressing in a moral way that they're happening at the same time. Like, it blows my mind that this isn't something that's more,
because they're on the same
side. I know, but this is what I'm saying, that it's so incredible that, like, now you would see some, whatever, people who are happy that Syria is going to be welcomed back to the Arab League. I don't know if that has happened. It's going to happen, whatever. I'm sure it's going to happen.
I think it happened.
It happened, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, it's going to be welcomed to the Arab League. It's like, okay, cool. But, like, who are these states welcoming it back? Many of the most powerful ones are also the same ones who have normalized with Israel recently. And Saudi Arabia will just do it at some point. Like, it's... Who is doing the talking here? Like, who are we even? How are we still pretending that there is a our side here in terms of like the big states? Like, I don't understand this. I am genuinely as invested in dismantling, or at the very least, significantly reforming the Arab League, significantly reforming the Arab League, as I am about thinking about the state of Israel or the state of fucking Syria. That, you know, I'm at this stage right now where I've seen all of these experiments reach is sort of a natural end, if that's maybe too optimistic, I don't know. And I'm trying to think of, like, what is this thing that we can build in the future that doesn't rely on the same mistakes that were caused in the past? And this is like the super vague and vaguely optimistic maybe take on this. But anyway, I've been reading to Mr. Snyder because he has a, you know, I'm sure lots of flaws as well, but he has a very good way of talking about or teaching about Eastern Europe. That's kind of a specialty, especially Ukraine. And he's the one, among others, among Ukrainian writers, obviously, who has kind of reframed Ukraine for me in a way to understand why it is so central. What is it about that country that most Europeans who are not directly impacted by it never really thought about it before the invasion, or the full-scale invasion, I should say. Why is it so significant? Why did both Hitler and Stalin, why were they so obsessed with Ukraine? Why is Putin still obsessed with, what is it about that place that's so, you know, obsession worthy? And this is something that Poland used to occupy that space as well up until the Second World War, obviously, and even after. And today it's just Ukraine when it comes to Europe. And for me, there's something there. There's something very interesting happening there, in addition to something very horrifying happening there. And Snyder has an interesting way of framing it, I think, that has helped me. So I've been reading The Road to Unfreedom. I've read Bloodlands, which is one of the most difficult books I've read on the Holocaust. And yeah, his writing in general. So that's what I can recommend on the spot right now, because I'm reading it. But if you have anything that you're reading, feel free to share. Otherwise, tell us what you're watching, whatever.
Yeah. No, I mean, again, I didn't really have a lot of time to prep, but just off the top of my head, Yellow Star, Red Star, Holocaust Remembrance After the Communism by Yelena Sobotich. And then the book, it's kind of an older book, but I think still has sections that are very useful, called Taboo Memories, Diasporic Voices by Ella Shahat. Yeah. So I think, you know, that kind of is relevant to the discussions we were having, and interesting perspectives from like an Arab Jewish perspective, as well as like how memory works, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm, and how memory is weaponized, mm-hmm, in Europe.
I should also mention, given the obvious discussion, like the book The Holocaust and the Nakba is a very interesting, it's a series of essays, mm-hmm, for those who don't know. It's very, the essays are very different from one from the other. And it's very interesting to kind of use, I didn't read all of them, I read most of them, use them as kind of points of departures to kind of do different explorations for those who are interested in that kind of thing. There's a book that came out last year, I think. I haven't read it yet, but it's something, I'll find the name and put it in the show note, but something like the 1948 War and Hebrew Literature or something like that. Like, how was the...
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, I think it's from last year. How was the War of Independence, quote unquote, and also the Nakba, how was it reflected in the literature of the time? So that's something that I will, you know, I don't even know if I can recommend it. I have not read it yet, folks. So do not sue me if you do not like it. I will read it at some point. It looks interesting. But anyway, okay. With that in mind, Dana, thanks a lot for this. As always, this was an interesting and fascinating and blah, blah, blah chat. and hopefully listeners agree, because if they don't agree, I mean, why are they listening? How is this my fault? You know, like, how
I mean, you've stuck around this
long. It's on you. I always say this, like, honestly, it's on you. It's your, you should pick up hobbies.
Thank you, and blah, blah,
guys,
blah.
Guys, pick up hobbies. It's not my fault. Okay. Thanks, Dana.
Yeah, take care, man.
The Far East Times is hosted by myself, Joey Ayu. I am also its producer, researcher, writer, and sound editor. If you want to help turn this project into a full-time job, please head out to patreon.com/FireEastTimes to support it. These episodes are part of a bigger project which includes resources, a newsletter, and eventually YouTube video essays as well. As always, thank you for listening and take care.